I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Bleeding on the Page. The story we're about to listen to is Tony Blair's First Day in Hell, written by George Pritchard and performed by Samuel Jones, Ollie McCauley and Max Bardsley, with additional sound design by Ollie McCauley also.
Anthony Charles Linton Blair recoiled in horror as he looked upon the horrendous view laid out before him. Thick, sulphurous fumes and billowing violent fires smouldered and encircled him. The very fabric of the atmosphere vibrated with a harrowed energy. Though he appeared to stand on solid ground and perceive a demonic landscape as far as his eyes would take him, this dimension ultimately lacked form, circumference and centre. No order here, just chaos and screams.
Where am I? What is this place?
Cried the former PM.
Come on now, Tony.
Blair spun round to meet a shrill and well-spoken voice from behind. Through the putrid gas, a figure began to emerge. A woman, well-postured and confident in her stride. Around her head ran a mane of wavering hair like the fires that enveloped them. The figure stepped out from the haze to meet his whimpering gaze with blue, piercing eyes. Blair recognised her stern glare, her thin smile. He had known this woman in another time, another place.
Don't ask questions you already know the answer to,
quipped Margaret Thatcher like a scolding mother superior. Blair turned his gaze to the dreadful vista once more and sunk to his knees.
Oh, bloody hell.
Precisely,
said Thatcher, pulling him by his collar to his feet with surprising strength. Blair's despair was compounded with confusion.
I don't understand, Margaret. I cut crime and youth unemployment, facilitated massive record growth and child numeracy, the National Minimum Wage Act, free fruit for most 4 to 6 year olds. What more could I have done?
Do I really need to spell it out for you, Tony?
Blair sighed. What little light remained in his eyes suddenly dimmed, and a weary expression that had haunted him in his later years moved across his sullen face.
You're talking about Iraq, aren't you?
Yes, Tony, of course I am. Though there was Afghanistan as well, wasn't there? And Kosovo and Sierra Leone. Come to think of it, you were quite the crusader.
Blair's heart grew heavier still. A feeling stirred deep within him. A feeling he had often suppressed in his post-ministerial career. Remorse. Blair had always surrounded himself with supporters, friends and allies, which acted to his conscience as a buffer against unwanted criticism of his government's thundering scramble for war and its aftermath. After his 10-year reign as Prime Minister had come to an end, he had worked hard to distract himself with indemnified and yet somewhat menial work, such as senior advisor at JP Morgan Chase, or using his devilish charms to deliver lectures for hundreds of thousands of dollars. But in the smouldering void, these thoughts were difficult to censor. And so all his doubts and reflections were once again restored. Nevertheless, Blair steeled himself.
You're right. I was a crusader. I acted in good faith. I was only trying to make the world a better place.
The road to hell is paved with good intentions, Tony. Didn't you notice on your way in?
Blair was seized by boundless anguish at this cruel quip. But his frustrations were dispelled by an immense screaming entity that soared overhead, spewing teeth and hot embers in its wake.
See, we're not too different, you and I, Tony,
continued Thatcher, circling him as he sat recovering on the floor.
We were a different sort of politician, reformers, visionaries, the last of our kind. We had ideas, Tony, and we acted on them. England's future was recast in our wake.
Don't you mean Britain's?
Don't interrupt me! Where was I? Ah, yes. And, of course, we both informally declared war on third world countries to varying degrees of success. In my weaker moments, I sometimes questioned my decision to send 255 men to their deaths for some rocks in the middle of nowhere. But even in the face of infinite damnation, I'd do it again. Even the most liberal, C&D-touting, THC-ridden beatnik knows in his heart of hearts that we couldn't have just allowed those argies to seize our land. I mean, what the hell were they thinking?
I would have done the same.
I said don't fucking interrupt me! The fact of the matter is, Tony, people liked that war. Even the people who say they don't. I certainly liked it. It set me up for two election victories, thereby allowing me to lay the foundation of a rational, free market-oriented legacy of leaders. Leaders like you, Tony. People commended me for my iron will. Every day I faced constant criticism. Don't close the mines, they said. You'll cripple the economies of the industrial counties. Or don't funnel money to loyalist paramilitary groups in Northern Ireland. You'll sow the seeds for years of conflict and divisiveness. They'd whinge, but no. I did it all anyway, because it was the right thing to do.
Thatcher suddenly turned heel and looked directly into Blair's hollow eyes.
But you... you really fucking wanted to go to war with those Yanks, didn't you? And you did. I really must admire you for your iron will, Tony. No, no, no. You aren't going to let anything stop you. Not a million demonstrators, not the UN, not a lack of any tangible evidence or contradictory reports and intelligence.
You had a gut feeling, and you went for it. We may differ in some of our views, but in my eyes... you're a man of conviction.
So why am I down here?
Yeah, I think that to myself every day.
Thatcher crossed her arms and rested her bony fingers on her chin as she began to deliberate on their circumstance.
I suppose the things we did that we thought were right were actually only beneficial for a very narrow and select section of society and detrimental to almost anyone else. Let's not kid ourselves. We knew lives would be ruined as a result of our decisions, but we did it anyway, for better or worse. Still, you've got eternity to reflect on it. You'll figure it out sooner or later.
She said, waving her arms nonchalantly. Blair begins to sob. Thatcher rolls her eyes, but she tries to comfort the formal Middle Eastern peace envoy anyway.
Ah, come on, Tony. It's not so bad down here, really. Though, in fairness, I was conceived here, so it is just like home for me. I shouldn't really tell you this, but after your first eon, they let you mingle with all the other damned souls before your next eternity.
Blair looks up and wipes his eyes.
Really? Like who?
All the old gang. Half of my party, half of yours. Ronald, Clinton, Cheney, Obama. All your old pals too. Campbell, Murdoch, the Bushes. It'll be just like the good old days before all the weirdos took over.
George is down here.
Sure. Anyone with any real guts winds up down here. There's a members lounge for all the best damn souls. I'm sure they'll let you join. Oh, you just have to meet Pinochet. He's such a good laugh.
I see,
said Tony, composing himself. He gets up to his feet and clears his throat.
Well, that's okay then, I suppose. Would be good to see all the old boys again.
Exactly, that's the spirit. There is, of course, the eon of poetic punishment to get out of the way first, but that'll fly by.
Right. And what's that?
I don't know, not up to me. But you can tell me all about it afterwards, though. Good to see you again, Tony. Welcome to hell!
With that, Thatcher seemed to fade out of existence, and in her place swirled fire and smoke once more. Blair looked around at the horrible screaming void around him. The heat was unbearable, and the constant howling winds deafening. In the distance, through the gases and the filth, he thought he saw another silhouette, that of a small child staggering aimlessly around before it vanished as swiftly as it had appeared. Suddenly, he was hit from above by a brilliant iridescent shaft of beautiful white light. Blair shielded his eyes from the sudden burst of ethereal rays. As his eyes adjusted, he began to perceive some kind of portal, shimmering in the air far above him. Faintly, he heard distant harmonic melodies and vibrations cutting through the howls and roars. Then something struck him on the head with a thud. Blair looked to see what it was and to his utter amazement beheld a thick hemp rope, strong and good. Blair was overcome with deepest relief and ecstatic joy. This was surely a second chance from heaven. Perhaps the Lord had heard their conversation and realised that he hadn't meant to take quotes from the UN Weapons Inspector's report out of context in his motion to Parliament. It was all just a big misunderstanding. Blair grappled the rope tightly and began to hoist himself with a grunt towards salvation. He saw once again the silhouette of the child, only there were many more this time, and more distinct, 10 or 12 small figures slowly emerging from the shadows. Blair wasted no time in trying to figure out what was going on and began to pull himself with all his might up and out of these accursed fathoms. Each pull was a terrible strain on his lanky arms. A life in business and politics hadn't allowed much time for physical acumen, but the roaring flames below drove him onwards, while the radiant assonance above beckoned him forth. Panting and heaving, Blair looked down to see how far he had come, but was met by a bizarre and unseemly sight. Just below him, plain enough, there had formed a congregation of more and more of these children, scores upon scores, with more coming through the smoke and fire. The ground below was fast becoming a heaving crowd, and as the nature of these figures began to clarify, Blair was seized by his most violent and profound terror yet. They were Iraqi children. Dead Iraqi children. Burnt, battered, bruised. Some had been crushed by great weights, others crawled along the floor limbless. Others were little more than burnt-out skeletons, but they were all furious. Through the roaring fires of hell, Blair could hear their pained screams of anguish and vengeance. All of them howled and bellowed with righteous fury and raised their arms as if to tear Blair down back to them. Still more gathered, an army of souls baying for blood. He could see soldiers now too, in British uniforms, shot up and ripped apart as the rest of them. Their chorus of agony and retribution pushed through Blair's pointy ears like a hot needle, till he was forced to break free from his petrified stupor and continue to clamber upwards towards safety. He reached out and grabbed the rope to hoist himself further, but as he did, found his hands sliding back down. Again, he swung his hand upwards but found no purchase. To Blair's horror, he realised that not only was he unable to progress up the rope, but that he was actually beginning to slide down it, further and further towards the torment below. It was as if someone had suddenly greased the rope. In fact, it felt exactly like that. Blair looked at the length above him and saw dark streaks of crimson. He opened his palm and saw they were covered in blood. It seemed to materialise right there like a spring until it dripped and trickled down his arms. It made any attempt to scale the rope an impossibility. Blair sighed deeply.
Oh. Very clever.
And then, accepting his fate, he let go of the rope and plunged into the mass of vengeful souls below where they had set upon him horribly, tearing at his body, biting, scratching, stripping the skin from his flesh and the flesh from his bones, and breaking him down into pieces for now and the rest of time. The end.
Nice.
Cool. Welcome to Bleeding on the Page. What we've just listened to is Tony Blair's First Day in Hell, which is written by our friend and, you know, human being, George Pritchard, who's in the studio with us right now. Hello, George. How's it going?
It's going very well. Pleasure to be here.
We also have Ollie McCauley.
Hello.
As per usual.
It's so lovely to be back. I feel Get like in. I've not been here for a while.
Yeah, it's been a while since you've been in the studio. Yeah. How's it feel to be back?
It's so exciting. Yeah. I love it. This is where I feel at home most.
Purpose reignited.
Exactly, without a doubt.
So, George, how the hell did this happen? How the hell did you come up with the idea of Tony Blair going to hell?
I suppose it's sort of been, you know, sort of 10 years in the making, I guess. The war in Iraq was quite a sort of instrumental event in my political awakening, I think. Mm. Like, I remember one of my earliest memories of anything political was being on a march, the million people-ish, in central London.
How old were you then? Must have been quite young.
Yeah, it was 2003-ish. I was like, yeah.
Five, six?
Something like that, yeah. A bit older. I didn't really understand it at the time, really. I just knew that there was a big war going on and that war was bad.
So you've always had this kind of disdain towards Blair because of Iraq.
Yeah, pretty much. It's like the first time that I started to realise that maybe, you know, the UK isn't exactly the good guys in the world. It was my first real sense of, like, injustice as well. So writing this, being able to sort of figuratively banish him to hell has been quite cathartic. Yeah.
But what sort of got you to just go like,
I'm gonna just type this out now. Was there anything that happened?
Actually, I don't remember
at the time,
I think,
or was it just something you'd always thought you'd wanted to do?
I've been sort of working on it on and off for like maybe a couple of years. So it might have been the Chilcot Inquiry, which came out in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I started writing it on just in the notes on my phone on like a really long train journey.
Deep train.
Kind of started. Yeah.
Has it sort of changed much, you know, from that first idea of Tony Blair waking up in hell? I know oftentimes when something starts as an idea but ends up on page as the finished product, there can be quite a change from the sort of content of the material, the original purpose that you set out to do. Was there any evolution in that for you there, or actually was it very direct process for you?
It was pretty much direct. I toured this idea of having him kind of be led by Margaret Thatcher through different sort of portals and a kind of Christmas carol kind of vibe to it. But I thought,
I'd watch that.
Yeah, I'm just not good enough of a writer to. I couldn't be asked, so yeah, I just left it in hell.
Well, I think you're very good, man. This script is loads of fun to perform as well.
Yeah, we had a really good time bringing it together. Yeah.
We were rehearsing.
Yeah, it's great hearing it. It's really fun to hear, actually. Yeah.
Was there because we spent a little while on this, obviously, like we were adapting to the things that we knew we could bring to it. Was there a lot of difference to how you imagined it, if you as a radio piece, or even just in your head, to actually how we've ended up performing it? Were there any like key changes there?
It'd be more interesting if I said yes, but no.
Exactly.
It was pretty much, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a lot more fun to hear it read out than it was to write it. Because I don't know, like whenever I'm trying to write something, I just think it's not good enough.
And when would you say you actually started writing? When was that something that you, when would you first start defining writing as a hobby for yourself?
In my life, I guess I've always written like sort of poems and things like that. I think maybe poetry was the first thing I started out doing.
When was that? What age?
I can't remember now. Just very six. Young, very young. Yeah, six. Yeah, something like
around
that.
The same time Tony Blair went into Iraq.
Yeah, started writing his first poem.
There's a correlation.
It was my inception.
Yeah, on that march.
Exactly when he started writing it.
You know, so with you as a writer, if you had to describe, do you think you have a process for how you approach writing? Is there a process for you, or do you find it's unique with each project? Like, How do you approach a new writing project when you go in on it?
Yeah, I'd say it's pretty unique. I tend to not work on things in one go. I tend to sort of leave it and then come back to it, and it's never usually in one sort of bulk.
That's like the opposite to us, because we always just have like deadline project, get it out as soon as possible.
That's the thing. I kind of wish I don't have deadlines anymore. The amount of uni is just like it's just me. Yeah, I'm not very good self motivated.
And in terms of the content. Motivated. Yeah. In terms of the content of this, this is super politically, super political in terms of themes and content. But is that something you work with all the time? What are the themes that you find yourself always come to the forefront when you're writing a text or a piece of script?
Often politics, I suppose, but sort of maybe existentialism. I'm kind of sort of into that. A little bit, yeah.
Have you watched Rick and Morty?
I don't know if his IQ is big enough.
Oh, no, that's right.
Yeah, but I mean, we've got a very exciting episode today.
Yeah,
I'm very glad to be joined by George, who does know quite a lot about politics, because, I mean, this is definitely going to be a politically heavy, meaty episode.
Because after we read this script, we just went off and decided to binge like as many like politically themed movies and TV shows as we could. Do you find that you draw from films often when you're writing? Do you use them do you think you consciously use them as sort of source material to define how you write stories?
Not for this so much, but. For when I'm writing films, definitely. Yeah.
Just kind of drawing that. I saw this TV movie called The Trial of Tony Blair.
Yeah, I tried to watch. I couldn't find it.
YouTube is the only way you can watch it.
All right. Well, it didn't look hard
enough. It's in parts
on
YouTube.
Yeah.
And that has because that's basically, it was made while Tony Blair was still prime minister, but it's sort of like an alternate history kind of story. And basically he gets put on trial for the war in Iraq, and you think it's going to be a whole like trial courtroom drama kind of thing, but it isn't. It's just like Tony Blair being a dick for like an hour. Like, it's him just driving around, and he steps down as prime minister, and then the Labour polls go up, and he's like, why has it gone up? I am great. I've made a legacy. And they just keep going, yeah, but the Iraq thing was pretty fucked. Yeah. And he's like, I did a lot more than just Iraq, guys.
To anyone who like who might be listening and doesn't understand what the Iraq thing is with Tony Blair, George, do you want to explain what it actually is that took place?
Yeah, so essentially there was a big war in Iraq in 2003 with America, and there wasn't really a good reason to go to war.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, allegedly it was to do with weapons of mass destruction, which there's no real tangible evidence of.
Wasn't that based off like a movie or something? I think Richard Curtis talks about that in his hypernormalization.
Oh yeah, he might have done actually. Yeah.
It says that apparently they just like the weapons of mass destruction. The description of it is like straight off this like 90s like American B movie, and there was like no proof of any like weapons.
Nah. They did used to have weapons of mass destruction. To be fair, but they'd all the UN's weapons inspectors found that they'd all degraded beyond use. But he was sort of a bit snidey in the fact that he took certain quotes out to make it sound like they still had it. I can't think of any examples now. But yeah, he's been a little sneaky boy.
Was
the real reason oil?
Yeah, basically.
Was it oil?
What?
Everything's about oil, man.
That's like anytime someone does anything bad, I'm like, was it oil though?
It's all about oil. It's all about oil. Everything.
Why did you cheat on her? Like, why did you like break her heart like that? Oil. That was so brutal. What?
Oil, man.
You did it for oil?
Yeah.
But how does that even relate to a romantic relationship?
Bro, it's so finite. Like, it's so important that we get the oil, man.
But this is a girl's heart.
You don't understand, man. You're not intellectual enough to get the oil, man.
So that's what Ollie's like all the time. It's so weird.
Yeah, it's
so
weird.
Straight up get the oil.
My first item is another unofficial trilogy.
So me and Sam have a little like thing where we try and find like films that you could organize in trilogies, but they're not meant to be trilogies.
Okay. So unofficial trilogy.
So like last week we had the unofficial trilogy we had were like fake Scorsese ripoff films. So American Made, War Dogs,
Big Short.
Yeah. All like completely like ripping off Scorsese and making
I can see that.
And this week the films are the Channel 4 TV movie The Deal is the first one. Then the second one is the movie The Queen. And then the third one is a TV movie for HBO and BBC called The Special Relationship.
Oh, I like that they all start with the. That's good.
That's nice. So that's the trilogy, films which begin with that.
On what this trilogy might be? Have you seen The Queen?
No, I've not seen any of these, unfortunately.
You've seen The Deal, Ollie?
Yeah, watched The Deal, yeah.
Yeah. Well, they're basically all written by a guy, the same guy, Peter Morgan, and they are the Tony Blair trilogy. So the first one shows how he sort of backstabbed Gordon Brown to get the leader role. The second one's like the death of Princess Diana and him dealing with like the Queen. And then the third one's about him and Bill Clinton's relationship.
Does it actually have a chronology?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
They directly continue from each one.
Nice.
Oh, well, but they're completely separate from each other.
Yeah, they're completely separate.
In terms of production.
But they've never been acknowledged as a trilogy, but it's always got the same actor playing Tony Blair, which is Michael Sheen.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He does do it.
He's
well,
so good.
He does it really good.
Me and Ollie watched The Deal last night.
Yes.
And if you haven't seen The Deal, it's so sick.
It is bossy.
It's really... I don't know if you'd like it, though, because it kind of shows or... positions Tony Blair as a bit of a rock star.
Yeah, a bit of an underdog.
He was a rock star. He was in the band.
Yeah, he plays the guitar and stuff,
Ed Miliband was in a band as well.
Ed Miliband, the band. Ed Miliband.
So, I think Chukka Uma was a DJ.
Chukka! Yeah, I mean...
Why do you think there's so many films which are about Tony Blair?
Well, it's just these three, because other than that...
And The Trial of Tony Blair,
which is completely different. The Trial of Tony Blair makes Tony Blair look like an absolute asshole.
These three movies,
they always make Tony Blair seem like
a legend.
Really, like, nice, great politician. The Special Relationship kind of hints at him. It ends with Bill Clinton saying to him, we worked together for... He said, why would you want to work with a Republican when you're a central-left politician? And then he goes, I don't think you are central-left anymore. I don't know what you are. That's what
wow.
I really want to talk about the ending. Special relationship, because it is the weirdest one in this trilogy.
I want to see that.
It's just Bill Clinton and Tony Blair kind of like... It's kind of like a rom-com movie. That's how it's structured. It's got like Tony Blair being like, wow, he's a wonderful man. And he's frightfully interesting. He's really giving me lots of great advice. And Bill Clinton like, yeah... He's a handsome man. Wouldn't you say, Hillary? She's like, well, I wouldn't call him handsome.
Bro, that's so weird.
Yeah.
Do you reckon
it's a bit homoerotic then.
Do you reckon something did happen between them? I mean, the three of them.
Listen, man, like, the whole world of Blair politics is mad.
Blair was like in a cupboard watching.
You know, if Bill Clinton was getting on a plane and going out to an island filled with underage women, then I don't think it's a huge stretch to think he also had a homoerotic relationship with Tony Blair.
I think
if we've got Pedophile Island, I don't think it's a huge stretch to also have a homoerotic relationship.
Because the special relationship, the main conflict is about Bill Clinton being accused of committing adultery with Monica Lewinsky. And Tony Blair standing there in front of everyone, they're like, what do you think of this? What do you think of this? And he's like, I think Bill Clinton's a great man. He's been a wonderful friend to me.
He's so good.
I think Michael Sheen's performance of Tony Blair is really great.
Yeah, it is good.
The problem I have with this trilogy is ultimately it's just kind of... It's not real. It doesn't feel real to me.
Well, the thing that I took from the deal is it does feel a bit biased. Yeah. It feels very pro-Tony Blair. But I think that's always the space that you get in with political movies anyway. Because I was watching The Iron Lady before I came here as well. And... you know, it's like you never feel like it goes hard enough. You always want them to really dissect these politicians. But it goes for everything, like Vice as well. The Cheney movie is but completely going the other way. No, it's just he's evil.
Yeah.
But it's not a balanced profile of any of the politicians. It's always either they're good or they're bad.
I do think that Sheen's performance, if it was, it's all about the direction and stuff. It's about how it's done like that. But I think Sheen gets that kind of slightly slimy quality to him. He says things and he kind of. You kind of watch him blink a few times before he goes, yes, I do agree.
He definitely captures the slimy lawyer energy.
He's definitely always thinking about how he hates everyone and how he's just going to fuck them over.
He is always fucking people over. He fucks people over in the deal.
His whole career.
Yeah, exactly. But the Queen is Princess Diana's death, and they blame it on the photographers, and they have the royal family.
At this point, we know it was an assassination.
Yeah, we know
for a fact.
It's fact. Yeah, so I mean, it's just all a bit disingenuous, and the drama of it is always about. It's always a bit emotional. It's a bit drama. It's not got enough politics in it for me.
Mm.
I think the trial of Tony Blair is that is not political either, but it is just showing Tony Blair to be an arsehole.
Which you like more.
That does sound fun, though.
Right. But Iron Lady, you were saying...
Well, I wanted to ask George about, are there any films that you resonates particularly with you or you find interesting?
British politics, maybe not so much.
There
was one Tony Blair thing called... The trial. No,
that's what we've just talked about. There's this great film called The Trial of Tony Blair.
Have you heard of that? Have you guys seen that?
So it was Comic Strip Presents, and then it's about Tony Blair, gets done for war crimes, and he kind of goes on what's the Alfred Hitchcock film? The 39 Steps kind of chase thing.
Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
What does he do? Does he kill people? Does he get hanging?
What happens in the film?
I can't remember. It was a long time ago. I can't seem to find it. But yeah, that's the funniest Blair thing. There must be, surely.
Yeah. Because I was watching The Iron Lady, which I found interesting. I was interested in The Iron Lady because it's a theatre director who actually directed it, and she's particularly unique in the sense that she's always making films, theatre plays with women alone. She's very female centric. The one who did the Shakespeare play with just women, I can't remember her name.
That's what she's named.
It's called Just
Women.
Just for Women.
Who plays Thatcher?
Meryl Streep. Meryl Streep plays Thatcher. And again, I found that very tonally interesting because it does seem to want you to sympathise with Thatcher quite a lot, but it also shows her being a dickhead. Yeah. But it also weirdly frames her dickheadedness, her policies. Just you see her going we know this will be best for the country. You know, just because the Brits don't want to take their medicine, just because the medicine will hurt you, doesn't mean it's not good for you.
the thing with it is as well is the only way to make her sympathetic is to just show her as a weird, frail woman who doesn't know what's happening.
That's how they incite sympathy for Margaret Thatcher is they show her losing her memory and hallucinating her dead husband.
Yeah. So it shows her blowing up a boat full of kids, young Argentinian children. Blow it up! And then it cuts to her being Harold, I can't remember anything. Oh, help
no.
And the audience is just like, oh, she was all right.
Yeah. She was a good woman.
She was struggling.
But, I mean, I would like it just to be starting off, young Margaret Thatcher. She's going to get to the top. She's going to, you know, be the first female prime minister, and like a rise and fall kind of thing.
You just want it simple.
You had so much potential. You became leader.
But I quite like.
Everyone was around you. And then you started to become more and more like, into Reagan, and you started selling off the post office, selling off the rail station.
The venom that you said Reagan closing. With then was
Reagan,
into Reagan, like
Reagan,
closing the mines down, and then everyone just hating her to go from that. I think that would have been such a great movie, and then they just littered it with this like really like soft, like kind of like frail, like.
Yeah, because we were talking as well, like of the idea of like British politics. British politic films being almost a genre onto themselves because you got that Tony Blair trilogy, but you also have like Brexit and Uncivil War, which was like massively published, so I think like quite a few people might have checked out. Benedict Cumberbatch.
Oh yeah, I saw I've seen bits of it because it's used loads.
It's so good.
It's very well made, but it's interesting, they have a really unique tone to them. It's hard to describe. It's like Rainy Days, and all the shots of Parliament and stuff are like quintessential, but like the London streets and stuff like that are like really important.
It's like it's kind of like the thick of it as well. It's just like those scenes where
the thick of it's in
just
that
always
space.
Those scenes of like well, he's going to be planning this.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to be doing this.
Yeah, and it's the power dynamics that are so unique to British politics that make them really interesting to watch.
It's so old.
Watch.
It's like thousands of years old, and I think that's part of what makes it so engaging.
Yeah.
Because, I mean...
It's like the English political system is so, like you said, it's so ancient now that it actually means that, like, politics have to be conducted in England in such, like, a weird... Everywhere, really, but England conducts politics in such a weird way, and all the dynamics and interpersonal relationships are so like indirect and kind of like you have to communicate through other people, you have to take the long way around to have any type of effect. And so making films where people are required to do those things, I always think like makes such interesting cinematic film like experiences. But the US have like their equivalent as well, because like the US have had a real upsurge in kind of like politically criticizing themselves, because obviously like Vice came out which was huge. Did you guys watch it?
Yeah, I loved Vice.
You loved it. I hated Vice. I nearly walked out of Vice. It's like one of the first films I nearly walked out of.
What didn't you like about it?
Everything. I think it falls into budget Scorsese stylisms, which I like find.
That's
work.
Not the problem with it, though.
It's not the problem
I
with it.
I think the problem with it is it's got this real like kind of tone of it of.
Actually, like, I do think it ties into the problem.
We didn't know what they were saying in this room, but like they were probably saying something like this, and like this constant.
That
like,
is the budget Scorsese.
This like, constant, just like of like breaking up the format to like shove yourself in there, and it was just so like ADHD kind of like. Every scene had to be as like loud and
it felt try hard edgy without being sincere.
In my opinion.
What saying.
What do you like about Vice? What worked for you?
I just found it fascinating. I didn't really know much about Chaney, so I was just intrigued to see.
I think the best way to learn about Chaney is through Sacha Baron Cohen, who is America, when he interviews Chaney and makes him sign a waterboard. Because there's a point in Vice where they cut to an image of a leopard taking a deer down, and it's like completely out of focus.
This is fun. Have you seen The Big Short? You saw The Big Short.
Yeah, I saw The Big Short. The Big Short, I'm much happier to. I think that's still budget Scorsese. It's still budget Scorsese, but I like The Big Short better because I think it's better written. Like, I don't even think that guy, the narrator, annoyed me so much. Why am I telling you this story?
You'll
because I am
later.
Chaney's heart. That's the twist.
Is that a joke?
No, the narrator
is a guy who got hit by a car and then his organ was given to Chaney's.
Yeah, so Chaney, he had a heart transplant. He was the heart that Chaney got in a heart transplant.
So I was kind of like slightly like interested to watch this, but that is. What is that?
It is. That's a genuine moment where he goes, why am I narrating this to you?
That makes me a little bit sick in my own mouth. That's awful.
Yeah, but let's not put down George. If George likes it,
you can think what you think. It's calm. Let the viewers decide.
Yeah, I think the acting is amazing in Vice. The acting is really good. And I think that US versus UK political thing, the best way of looking at that is House of Cards, because there's a UK season, but no one knows it. And I feel like I'm the only one who's seen this.
I saw a couple
UK
of episodes. I wasn't really into it.
Oh, man, I love it so much.
What, US or UK?
UK.
Because I saw a lot of US House of Cards before Kevin Spacey was a paedophile.
not before he was a paedophile, before he got...
Before I found out he was a paedophile. He was always a paedophile, sorry, my bad. Yeah. I did enjoy it, though.
Yeah.
Do you think the UK House of Cards is stronger?
It's very different. Like, it's really, really different. It's so slow. The UK House of Cards is like the slowest thing, and like the music is just this like orchestra, like and there's like long walking shots and then like long conversations.
That sounds terrible.
No, but
that's just 70s, bro.
Yeah, it's old though. It's like old.
Oh, yeah, okay. Old TV loves showing you like people answering the phone.
The main character is this like really like this like backbench like Tory, and he like works his way up to being prime minister. And then the second season is when there's a new king crowned, and he starts doing speeches that are like a different to his, and they start like locking. They start getting into an argument.
That sounds interesting.
I think it's amazing. I think it's some of the best TV I've ever seen. But it's really politically dense. It's very politically dense.
Is it better than The Thick of It?
The Thick of It works better as a comedy, but as a serious drama.
No, but yes or no, is it better or worse than The Thick of It?
In my opinion, yeah, I think it is better than The Thick of It.
All right.
What you said about the score has made me a little bit worried, though. Oh, that's a big thing for me when it comes to
TV shows. You'll like it, I think.
Do you think I'm going to like it?
You're probably. Yeah. You like Mickey's show.
There's those shows that aren't even that good, but then the score is good, and I'm like, oh, this is a great show.
It's not a show that you watch with other people, basically.
You just watch it on your own.
You watch it on your own, sad and a bit drunk.
That's cool.
I don't know why. I'm trying to think of films that I've watched on my own, sad and a bit drunk.
I think one of
I watched
was,
a really good Western.
I watched. I think I watched The Campaign with Will Ferrell. Political.
I watch any movies by Will Ferrell.
Yeah,
on
Adam
my
Sandler
own.
And stuff.
I don't watch anyone else, but I do have a weird obsession with them. So
they are like so stupid. Like,
well, it's so. I don't know if I've spoken about this on the podcast, but I like strongly believe that like Will Ferrell movies always have like one moment in them which are like past the threshold weird. They're like too odd, and I don't understand how they could have been approved to be put in these films, which
I
get the sense are meant to be commercial. In The Campaign, Will Ferrell punches a baby.
Yeah, and a dog. And like
But
the thing is, when he punches a baby, it's like a slow motion shot, and you watch this soft baby's head become a crescent.
You watch it get punched like Rocky.
He goes full peanut head then. He's like,
and it's like, why is that in the film? And then in like Get Hard, there's a sequence where Will Ferrell joins like a gang, a black gang in America, and wears a beanie where he calls himself Mayo and keeps calling it talking in gang slang.
Because it's
and so it's
funny.
Like it's always a bit uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, it's funny though, because this week a Netflix original came out which is all about politics. It's called The Politician.
So I've seen that. Advertisers though. Is it any good? Like,
so yeah, I mean, me and Sam have been digesting it. It's an odd one.
I do want to give it a watch because it looks kind of interesting.
It's made by Brad Falchuk and Ian Brennan, who did American Horror Story.
And Glee.
And Glee.
Oh, that's sold.
Right. Well, they did American Horror Story and Glee.
Yeah.
and that makes loads of sense if you watch The Politician.
Cool. Yeah. They've also added
another creator in as well who they haven't worked with before in terms of a showrunner, and that's a guy called Ryan Murphy who made Scream Queens.
Oh.
And wrote a load of Glee episodes. So I think The Politician, very, very camp.
Very camp. There are genuine sequences as well. There are genuine song sequences in it. They put song performances sometimes just out of nowhere. And you can spend 3 minutes like watching a song that doesn't progress plot.
There's a guy
and it's just because they like music.
He's like a musical theatre performer, I swear, the guy that's the main dude.
So the guy who's the main dude has been in the
Book of Mormon.
Book of Mormon, yeah.
Yeah, what's his name? I can't remember his name.
Yeah, I can't remember either.
But he's, I feel like I've recognised him.
And he's really good in it as well, because the politician basically follows a kid who's like, he's a career politician.
He's in high school.
He's in high school, but he fancies himself as a career politician. He thinks he's president. A psychopath. He wants to be the president of America. And he's trying to get into Harvard. And to get into Harvard, he needs to win the election, the high school election to be class president.
That's not what happens.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not.
He wants to get into Harvard, and it relies on him
to get into Harvard.
Yeah, because he does.
He wants to be president because
he needs to be class president to get into Harvard.
Yeah, he wants to be class president because loads of other presidents have been class president. To get into Harvard, he just needs to give them money. Like, they don't give a shit about him being class president.
But he wants to get in. No, they do, because he doesn't get into Harvard because he...
That's because the rumors comes out.
All right.
Trust me, I know this.
Okay.
Yeah, basically he's just spent his whole life trying to be the president, and now he's, for the first time, he's actually running a campaign to be high school president. So it's like a high school American kind of
political comedy
thing,
drama,
but then with politics at its core as well. And it's really camp, and the whole theme of it is authenticity. And about when people are being authentic and when they're being fake. Because you could sort of accuse every character in this show as being a sociopath because of how little they actually care about other people and how everyone is just using each other.
It's just politics, pretty much.
Yeah. But it is also really funny.
It's very funny. It's interesting because it sort of walks the line. It's kind of, it doesn't... The main character, he's never positioned politically within the story, clearly. And it kind of sells politics as being entirely apolitical and being completely about serving what will get you success and where you will, how to climb up the ranks of status, essentially. Them playing with that and those kind of that apoliticality of it is what makes it really interesting, because it's all these characters without morals serving themselves entirely, and there's so many political sequences that are really funny just because of how dark they are. He has a weird romance with the most popular guy in high school, but they're both meant to be straight, but essentially they don't care about sexuality. Their sexuality isn't relevant to them. They're not there to label each other. But then the guy he slept with starts running for president, and he just comes in and goes, "If you fucking run, I'm going to tell everybody that we fucked each other. I'm going to tell everyone that you're just gay and no one will vote for you." And this guy's "I'm actually really depressed. I'm not happy." He's like, "I don't care. No one cares about their emotions." There's a moment where he's with his girlfriend and he's "Could you be more honest with me? Could you be more sincere?" She's "Okay, yeah, I'll try and pretend to be more sincere with you." And he's "No, I want you." So it's weird. You see that the parts of Glee that are there, the kind of Glee aspects, because everyone is very camp. It's kind of got its thumb on kind of the nature of young people today and how they perceive politics.
Exactly.
It also has that American Horror Story vibe where it's kind of completely doesn't care about, wants to shock you as well and disturb you.
So what this show sort of conventionally would have is a character who's the everyman, who's just a normal person from a broke school. And he's "Oh, I met all these rich kids who are well into politics and now my life has completely changed. They're all wacky, but I like them." But there isn't that character. So you just start off in this really insane world and there's no one you can relate to at all. And you're watching it and you're not even sure if you're watching a comedy, really. And actually, there are times where me and Max are is that supposed to be fun? We genuinely can't figure out when it's trying to be funny and when it's trying to be sincere, because all of it is ridiculous because the characters are so over the top.
Okay.
So, I would really recommend it, to be honest. I think it's great.
It's a weird thing because it's really hard to grasp whether you feel like the showrunners want you to like their protagonist or dislike them. You're not sure whether you're meant to be on board, whether you're meant to find their mannerisms funny and cool, or whether it's actually meant to crease you, because sometimes I'll just really cringe at the show and I don't know if they're making me cringe consciously or if they're just too enwrapped in what
they're
doing.
Because they're just rich young kids who are just really weird.
Because my first impression of the show when I started watching it was just this is just all about making rich kids seem really cool and trendy and with it. And that puts me off massively, because it's that Made in Chelsea vibe where it's just dickheads being portrayed as heroes, and I can't bear that. Yeah. But then at the same time, they're so deplorable. But it also like shows them in such a good way as well that it becomes really hard to judge.
You can really analyse the show on rewatches.
Yeah.
I do think it's a great piece of art, and I do recommend it. Now, final item is, George, your surname is Pritchard, right? I'd like to talk to you about a show that I saw yesterday, the whole season, called The Amazing Mrs. Pritchard.
I've not heard of that.
So The Amazing Mrs. Pritchard was made in 2009, and it's about a woman who's the manager of a greengrocer's store in Northern England, and she's really great and everyone likes her in the shop. And then there's a political debate that happens outside the greengrocers. Two MPs who are running start arguing. They start fighting, Labour and Conservatives. And she gets up and she breaks up the fight. And she says to the camera, she's like, "This is ridiculous. I could do better than this." And then what follows is she runs for MP. And within the same election, she starts her own party. And within the same election, she becomes Prime Minister. So it's about a normal middle-class mum. No, not even working class, northern woman who doesn't know anything about politics, being elected Prime Minister of the UK and going into the Houses of Parliament, debating, coming up with policies and going up with all the political stuff.
Is it good?
Yes. I thought, literally, it's a gem. It's a wonderful gem.
Yeah, I've not heard of it. Nice.
Yeah, it's what I find so funny about it is literally just like a mum who's prime minister, and she's going around being like, the first thing she becomes prime minister, they're like, "Oh, there's like a terrorist action happening in Iran. We've got like four British officers who've been like kidnapped," and she has to actually use her like powers as a store owner, like manager and greengrocers, to kind of like understand and go through the world. And she makes up policies such as every Wednesday no one's allowed to drive their cars, like to save on climate change.
Nice. I'm just glad there's another good political Pritchard out there to counteract Mark Pritchard, the horrible Tory MP. Yeah. Even now, or even.
Yeah, because it's like each episode's an hour, so it's like a 6 hour long like kind of drama. Political drama about
that. Sounds amazing.
I still stand by the fact that actually the best political film that's out at the moment is like UK Parliament as it is right now. I think that's the best viewing you can get.
Yeah,
the best
television
that you can get. I'm so glad they brought it back.
I know, so like, good. They cancelled it for a bit, yeah, but now it's...
Right, it's so good. I love watching all of the like House of Commons stuff. I remember watching Boris's first address in the House of Commons, and I was like, I was crying. Like, it's so funny.
If no one's ever watched like UK Parliament right now, because it's all up on YouTube, you can just go watch that shit on YouTube. But it is a room full of people insulting each other constantly, and occasionally people standing up and making speeches which are just geared to insult other people, either Corbyn or Boris, basically. And it's the best.
It's really good.
It's just like the insults at the moment are the strongest they could ever be, because everything is so extreme.
The vitriol's turned
up. Before, like, you could insult like Cameron or like Miliband or whatever, but like this time Boris has like immediately come in and like broken laws, like laws, and then accused of groping.
Yeah, he has. Who's he been accused of groping? Because Katie Hopkins, she came out and was like, "Did you see the tweet that Katie Hopkins put out about Boris? It's like, if he groped me at 20, I still wouldn't clean that thigh."
Oh my God. That woman. Yeah. If there's ever a sequel to this, like,
with her and a selfie of Boris.
If it's Tony Blair's like 5 millionth day in hell, then he needs to welcome Katie Hopkins in.
The next one should be Tony Blair welcoming Boris in.
Boris.
That would be Cameron.
Cameron.
Yeah.
I don't know why I didn't mention Cameron in the big list of people that are in hell.
Yeah.
Maybe he's not dead yet.
Maybe he's still alive. I feel like Cameron weirdly would pull through. And
I feel like he could live for like a long time. in some weird way. But
Cameron's such a cheeky boy, because like he came in and fucked like... Oh. It's gone completely dark in our recording studio. Damn.
Nice.
Have we had a power cut, Jack?
No, the computer's on.
Oh, okay.
Are we shutting down?
Well,
what an interesting ending.
Yeah, so if it is an ending. We're in pitch black.
Oh, not quite.
But yeah.
Thank you so much for coming in, George.
No worries.
And letting us perform the script. It was a lot of fun.
That was good.
It was fantastic.
It's completely dark now, so...
The amazing Mr. Pritchard.
But that was a great script, man. Thank you so much for bringing it in. We really appreciated it. It was great doing the podcast. If you liked it, leave a comment, send us an email.
Give us some more money. Subscribe onto the podcast. We can't afford power anymore.
Yeah. Studio 71 has run out of electricity. We will need a lot of help here. But yeah, thank you so much for listening. Really appreciate it.
Email in as well at inquiries@nitpicks.co.uk.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.